Hi, it's Diane. On My Mind This Friday, Robert Mueller speaks.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
In the 2 years he spent investigating, President Trump, special counsel Robert Mueller did not utter a single word. This week, he called a press conference and made a public statement. Mueller did not take questions from the press. He did not elaborate beyond his 448-page report. Mueller's statement did little to end the partisan divide over his conclusions and whether the president should face consequences. Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, came into the studio to walk us through it. Molly Ball, it's always good to see you.
Wonderful to see you, Diane.
Robert Mueller spoke out for the first time this week. What did you make of what he had to say?
On the one hand, he didn't say anything that wasn't in that 400-page report. On the other hand, it was quite powerful to see him in person, and it made quite an impression, I think, for a couple of reasons. Number one, we haven't seen him before. He was quite a public figure when he was the director of the FBI, but since he undertook this investigation in May 2017, the public has not seen hide nor hair of Robert Mueller. He has been this sort of spectral figure to many on the left. He's become almost a mythical figure. You see these memes of him as a superhero, T-shirts and tchotchkes, and I've seen beer koozies that say Mueller time on them. You go to, you know, Democratic events in New Hampshire, people are wearing the T-shirts. So he has become almost more myth than man as this investigation has gone on. And I think it was intentional, not because he was trying to create mystery, but because he wanted to let the investigation speak for itself and because he wanted to save whatever political capital he had for the right moment, for the moment that he deemed it necessary for his voice to be heard. So the fact that he decided to speak at all was remarkable. And then there was what he said. It's true that everything he said was already in the report, but the things that he put emphasis on, the things he decided to present in that not even 10-minute statement, obviously were meant to convey a message to the public and to the Congress.
Such as?
Well, he refuted the notion that the president and many around him, and to some extent even the attorney general, who is a friend of Bob Mueller's, William Barr, I think their relationship may have become a bit strained. But there has been this notion among the president's supporters that the report somehow exonerated him. Again, it says in black and white in the report and even in that first letter that Attorney General Barr put out that it did not. But just to make sure people got the message, he stood up and said, this did not exonerate the president. And he even said, had we found that the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. It didn't say that. And then he went on to explain why he did not choose to charge the president with a crime, which was a matter of Department of Justice policy that he felt bound to follow, and to explain the processes that he sees this information being useful to, which are the congressional process, in essence, the oversight and impeachment process that the Congress has undertaken.
It was interesting that he used that double negative.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
At first, the president used that to say, I'm not guilty, I'm innocent. But the more people thought about it, and especially the president, so he's not too happy with what came out of that report.
That's right. I mean, the report is quite damning of the president. But another thing that Mueller pointed out was that the report wasn't just a report about Trump. He wasn't appointed special counsel in order to investigate the president. He was appointed to investigate this matter of Russian election interference. And that investigation produced, I believe, 37 different indictments of people and entities, many of whom have already pleaded guilty. Some are going to jail. So he, I think, also wanted to paint that bigger picture. And he did say that this matter of interference in the American democratic process by a foreign enemy is something that should concern all of us. And that, too, may have been a little bit of a poke at the president, because he has been famously skeptical about that. Although then he tweeted yesterday, seeming to affirm that there was Russian help for his campaign, but saying that he had nothing to do with it. But yes, the Mueller report lays out 10 instances of potential obstruction of justice by the president. If you read the whole report, it doesn't look good for him. A lot of people aren't going to read a 400-page report. They do need some kind of summary of it, some kind of book report or Cliff's Notes. And I think what you heard from some Democrats or some opponents of the president after Mueller spoke was a little bit of angst that he didn't go further, because there is such a need for some kind of neutral arbiter who is not seen as partisan, who is not seen as having any kind of axe to grind, but who has very carefully marshaled the facts and come to a conclusion. And so the fact that Mueller held back from coming to a conclusion that was very explicit about criminality, about guilt, he said in his press conference that that would have been overly prejudicial and that it would inhibit whatever fair trial, essentially, the president is entitled to. But I do think that you heard from some of the president's opponents a wish that he would have been a little bit more definitive or even just more clear, right? There's a clearer way than a double negative to make that kind of statement.
So does that mean, in your mind, that the Democrats will issue a subpoena for the now totally civilian Robert Mueller, who is going to resume his practice of law?
I assume so. I assume they will first seek his voluntary testimony, as they have already. And if he declines, then I assume that they will seek a subpoena. This was another aspect of the press conference.
I do not believe it is appropriate for me to speak further about the investigation or to comment on the actions of the Justice Department or Congress.
And he implied that he would not like to testify further or testify before Congress. And he said that if he did, he wouldn't go beyond the report. But I think that the statement he made yesterday really illustrates that even without going beyond what's in the report, he could still have quite an impact on the public perception. And this is the quandary that the Democrats are facing, is that there is so much evidence already out there. There is so much we already know. This is why dozens of Democrats in the House already believe impeachment is merited, already believe that we know enough to know that the president has violated the Constitution and abused his power. But they need a way to present that evidence to the public.
Exactly.
In order to get people on board. And the way they need to do that is with some kind of public hearings, public testimony, public presentation of the evidence. And it's hard to do that when the White House is stonewalling across the board, and the special counsel himself would prefer to let this dense written report be his only testimony.
And yet there will be an investigation going forward. We're still awaiting tax results from New York and other places. Where do we go from here? 40 Democrats or thereabouts want Nancy Pelosi to move forward. She is in a tough bind because she believes that pushing forward on that kind of action would really turn voters off. Where do we go from here?
Impeachment is a complicated subject, but I don't think it's going to happen without Nancy Pelosi's blessing. Despite the fact that, as you said, there are now, I believe, 41 or 42 Democrats in the House who've said they want impeachment to start now, they're not going to move forward with this if as long as she's against it. However, Nancy Pelosi's position is not as simple as no. She has never said never. What she's said is not now. And she is sticking with that in part because, going back to your question about the investigations, these congressional investigations are still moving forward.
Right.
And two or three times now they have come before a judge with the White House's refusal to provide witnesses and documents and testimony. And the judges have basically laughed the White House out of court. The rulings have been swift and definitive. Now, the administration can appeal those rulings. They expect this to go all the way to the Supreme Court. But if other judges find these issues as cut and dried as they have been so far, Pelosi and her oversight team, the group of committee chairmen and staff who are primarily involved in these investigations, they have a meeting every Friday when Congress is in session to coordinate their strategy and make sure they're not stepping on each other's toes and decide how to proceed. This group wants to pursue that process. And as long as that process is moving, as long as that process appears to be bearing fruit or at least going in their favor, they want to let that play out. And so Pelosi's position is, what she says is, we won't impeach for political reasons, but we won't not impeach for political reasons. And what that means is, if impeachment is merited, if we have exhausted all of our investigative avenues and we are convinced that it is our constitutional duty, we'll do it even if we think it's a political loser, but we're not going to do it because we're just out to get the president and we're his political opponents. We're going to do it because we believe, based on the facts and the law, that it is necessary. So her position is that we're not doing it now. And there are 40 or so Democrats who want to do it now. And you now have several of the Democratic presidential candidates also taking that position. But there is a feeling among the Democratic caucus, even among some House members who are publicly supportive of the speaker's strategy, that we're going to get there somewhat inevitably, that because of the way that these investigations are going and because of the evidence that has already been gathered, if not yet presented. So the other part of Pelosi's position is that she has set a two-pronged standard for proceeding with impeachment. She has said, we're not going to do it without Republicans on board. It has to be bipartisan. And we're not going to do it without the support of the American people. So behind the scenes, that team of congressional oversight chairmen are working to make those things happen. They're working to get these investigations to a point where the public does support a deeper look at whether the president ought to be removed. They're working to get it to a point where maybe Republicans do come on board. They don't have very high hopes for the Republican Senate, but you do now already have one member of the Republican House of Representatives.
Tell me about him and why you think he in particular has moved to support the idea of impeachment.
Justin Amash is a very unique creature in Washington. He is an outlier in the Republican caucus, and I think it's important to make clear he's never been a conventional rank-and-file Republican good soldier. He's always been someone who thinks for himself and holds a sort of quirky set of libertarian positions. And in fact, the Republican establishment, such as it is, has tried to get rid of him before because he can be a thorn in the side of leadership with his insistence on consistency and on principle and on this type of consistent libertarian conservatism that he believes in. So while it is basically my job to question the motives of politicians, and it's almost always fair to do so, I think he's one of the people in Congress whose motives are the least in question. He is one of the most sort of pure of heart people in the whole Congress. He very rarely gives interviews, but he explains all of his votes to his constituents on Facebook. He's often the only no vote on bills that he doesn't agree with, even if they are otherwise unanimous and bipartisan, because of this insistence on principle. So he's similar to the former Congressman Ron Paul, except that I think Ron Paul would go out of his way sometimes to antagonize leadership. Amash doesn't do that, but he is annoyingly consistent to some in his party. And he is a true believer. And he read the whole report. And he says a lot of his colleagues haven't done this. And so when you hear, for example, the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, saying, oh, he's just doing this to get attention, that is not Justin Amash's MO. He is not someone who seeks attention or who takes positions for any reason other than he believes in them.
Interesting. He hails from Michigan. What kind of district does he represent?
It's a Republican district, and there are already rumblings that he may draw a primary challenge. But his constituents have supported him in part because they respect his views even if they don't agree with them over the years. And he held a town hall in his district. It's funny, he hasn't given any television interviews and hasn't really spoken to the press about his position on impeachment. He's tweeted about it. He spoke to a group of school children on the steps of the Capitol about it a couple of weeks ago. And then he did this town hall in his district because he wants to communicate it to his constituents and to the people, not necessarily to the media or you know, a cable news panel. So he gave this town hall in his district where he laid out the case, which is that he believes the president has committed impeachable offenses. And while he did get quite a bit of heckling from people who disagree with him, supporters of the president, he also got a standing ovation. And the feeling from reporters in the room was that the support for Congressman Amash actually outweighed the displeasure with him, at least in that room. But that tells you that may not be a representative. That's not a poll of his district. That's not, that doesn't tell you where public sentiment overall is in that district in Michigan. But it does tell you who was motivated to come out and talk to the congressman because of this. And it was mostly people who supported him. Now, they may be Democrats. They may be people who would never vote for him. But they applauded him for having taken this stand.
Now, a quick break. When we come back, more from Molly Ball.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the district,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Molly Ball. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. Molly, I want to go back to Nancy Pelosi. The president called her crazy, Nancy. What prompted that?
Well, the Trump-Pelosi relationship is a fascinating one. And it goes back quite a long time. If you want to go back to the very beginning, they actually met back when he was a Democratic donor. But since he became president, they have obviously been at odds. But until now, he has not seen fit to give her a nickname, and he has mostly treated her with respect.
Respect.
I have heard from some White House staff that it frustrates them that he seems rather deferential to her, that he seems to respect her, that he's not willing to really go after her. Well, now he has. And this was after the second meeting between the president and the Democratic leadership on supposedly on infrastructure, the other I word, as Speaker Pelosi likes to say. They had a first meeting several weeks ago on infrastructure. It seemed to go really well.
Right.
Speaker Pelosi and the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, got the president to agree on a $2 trillion public money spend on roads, bridges, public transit, on
which is
infrastructure.
Dreadfully needed.
Which is dreadfully needed and which has historically been a bipartisan thing. That changed a bit under the Obama administration, but it used to be that funding infrastructure was something that the Congress could really come together on every 5 years. That was a promising meeting. They scheduled another meeting. The idea was the president had this homework. He was supposed to come up with a way to pay for it. Well, the president himself, I don't think, is much of a fiscal conservative, but he's surrounded by fiscal conservatives in the Congress and in the White House staff who don't like the idea of spending $2 trillion of public money. So this meeting's on the calendar. The president's supposed to bring in a plan to pay for this infrastructure bill. And he storms in, yells at the Democrats for these investigations, says, I'm not doing anything with you until you quit it.
Stop.
And then he storms out and he has this supposedly impromptu press conference in the Rose Garden where he maligns Speaker Pelosi. So there's a few things going on here. What Speaker Pelosi said afterwards was that she believed what really happened was the president hadn't done his homework. He hadn't come up with a plan to pay for infrastructure. And so he came up with a pretext to call off the meeting. And this perspective was somewhat substantiated by the evidence, which is that waiting for the president in the Rose Garden was this pre-printed sign, and it had some numbers on it. And it wasn't numbers about roads and bridges and public spending. It was numbers about the Mueller investigation. It was how much the Mueller investigation had cost and how many days it went on and so forth. So the speaker pointed to this to say, well, see, he planned all along to stage this distraction and claim this was about Mueller investigation instead of infrastructure. And we believe it's really about infrastructure. So the other thing about the president's attacks on Speaker Pelosi is that he is running a very similar playbook to the way he talked about Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign, right down to these doctored videos, which were also something that you saw floating around in 2016, right down to questioning the stability, the mental health, and the physical health of especially older women politicians.
Where did that video come from? A doctored video somehow representing Speaker Pelosi as being drunk.
Well, I think it's important to point out, number one, Speaker Pelosi does not drink at all.
Right.
She, as far as I know, hasn't even had a drink in her life. When she first met her now husband, Paul Pelosi, he asked her out for a beer and she turned him down. So they went out for dessert instead, because even back in college, she's never been a drinker. But there's two videos actually in question. They're both taken from, she gives a weekly press conference on Thursday mornings in the Capitol to all of the reporters who cover her on the Hill. She has a tradition. She always gives the second question to a woman reporter for as long as she's been in that position. And at this particular press conference, she stammered a bit. Everybody probably does when they speak for a long period of time. So there was a version of that that was clipped and mashed together, sort of a highlight reel of the times that she had stammered. It wasn't doctored in the sense of the video being altered. It was just selectively edited. And that was played on Fox News to say, see, she stammered through her press conference. There's something off about her. And that clip from Fox News, the president actually retweeted and amplified. Now, there's another version of the video that you're referring to where the video was actually slowed down and altered to make her seem like she was slurring her words. And that is the one that Facebook now has received a lot of criticism for not taking down.
Right.
And that is a video that is also making the rounds on social media, again, to insinuate. And this is what the president said. He said, I've been watching her for a long time and she's losing it. And so videos like that, I think, help to create that suspicion among his supporters.
What prompted Nancy Pelosi to say, I pray for the president, his family, and most of all, this country?
This is after he called her Crazy Nancy, finally giving her that nickname, which he noticeably hadn't done before, and made those remarks about her losing it. And she's a master of this sort of mean mommy tactic, right? The whole I'm not mad, just disappointed tone. This is something she uses a lot when she's trying to get her way. And, you know, we saw her stand up to him during the shutdown and force him to give in. And he has said this too. She's a very tough woman. And she uniquely, I think, has been able to force him to capitulate. Now, she has been quite disparaging of him. She's not, you know, sort of always taken the high road. She's made all sorts of demeaning comments about the president, but they tend to be in this tone of sort of more in sorrow than in anger and sort of this sort of pitying tone. And I think that's probably part of what infuriates him about her.
Molly, where do you think the country is right now after Mueller's statement on the issue of impeachment?
I'll be interested to see when some polls come out whether anything is moved. I have studied public opinion on the impeachment question and on the Mueller investigation generally. And one thing that you find is that it's relatively consistent, kind of like with all things Trump. People's opinions of the president are pretty baked in. Support for Mueller has always been pretty high. Support for the special counsel investigation, usually well over 50%, sometimes as high as 60%. And that has not really fluctuated based on the ins and outs of what's going on in the news or what the president or Rudy Giuliani have come out and said about the investigation. Most of the public doesn't think it was a witch hunt, doesn't think that this was a hoax, doesn't think that this was just a bunch of angry Democrats. Most of the public believes that there was something to investigate. I've sat in on focus groups of independent voters who think, well, there's probably something suspicious there, even if we may not ever know what it was, or even if the president might have found a way to keep his own hands clean. And we saw since the Mueller report came out, since the first Barr letter, since the whole report, or at least redacted report, came out, consistently people have not believed that the president was exonerated. The president's insistence that the report exonerated him and that therefore he's innocent, a majority of the public has not agreed with that. A majority of the public does not believe that the president was exonerated. So did Mueller move the needle? I'll be very interested to see that. I'll be very interested to see if him speaking publicly change that. Now, public support for impeachment is also really interesting. It has been, over the course of the Trump presidency, as high as 49%. That's a lot. That is higher than any president since Nixon. And as you recall, you know, there's always calls to impeach the president. There was an impeachment of Clinton, of course, and there were calls to impeach Obama and George W. Bush and so on. But this is the highest that impeachment has ever been. It fell particularly after the 2018 election, possibly because people felt that with Democrats taking the House, there was a check on the president there. And it's also fallen a lot among Democrats. The thing that's really interesting is that with Speaker Pelosi and other Democratic leaders out there making the case that impeachment would be divisive and a political loser, you've had, over the course of the administration, as many as 80-90% of Democrats wanting impeachment. That number has dropped, and it's now 60%, 70%, even among Democrats. But the important number is among independents, and currently it's a minority of independents, generally 30-40% of independents who support impeachment, and that's why Speaker Pelosi and others believe that it's a political loser to go down that road.
Molly Ball, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.